Turning now to the book of the prophet Hosea and chapter 1, Hosea chapter 1 and verse 2, the beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. And the Lord said to Hosea, Go, take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. Well, our subject is Portrait of the Prophets and Hosea and how he speaks of Christ and of the Christian era. Well, we're looking at the prophets at the moment of the 8th century. Hosea, Amos, Jonah, Isaiah, Micah, they're the 8th century prophets. Hosea tells us in the first verse when he lived, when he prophesied, and it was during the kingdoms of in Judah, Uzziah, to Hezekiah, and Jeroboam the second in Israel, and those who followed him, apart from one 10-year kingdom, the others were all relatively short. And out of the six kings that followed Jeroboam the second up in the northern kingdom of Israel, well, it was the last 30 years of that kingdom before the Assyrians would bring about the fall of Samaria and the land, and the 10 northern tribes and Israel would be no more, 722 BC. But some while before then, here is the ministry of Hosea, possibly up to 45 years of prophesying, ministering, something like 755 to 710 BC. And he would have known those contemporary prophets, particularly Amos, maybe Jonah, possibly Isaiah, although it looks as though Hosea mainly operated in the north, in the kingdom of Israel, while the others were in the south, in Judah. But nevertheless, they were contemporaries. So we're looking at this so-called minor prophets. The minor prophets are so-called not, of course, because they are any less as prophets than the other prophets, but because their books are the shortest of the writing prophets. So we look at Hosea. Just the opening 2, 3, possibly into the 4th chapter will be sufficient to enable us to grasp the book and to be able to benefit from it individually a lot more. Well, the land, first of all, during the early part of Hosea's ministry, was very, very prosperous. In fact, Israel in the north, Judah in the south, taken together, they would have been, but they were two nations, but if you view them as one, they would have been easily the largest and the most prosperous country on that side of the Mediterranean. And that's largely because in the north, in Israel, Jeroboam the second, who had a very long reign, had succeeded in reclaiming so much land that had been taken by the Syrians and the Transjordan area. So there was a vast amount of fertile land, and the land became very, very rich and very prosperous, but very evil at the same time. They didn't credit their prosperity to the blessing of God. They ignored the word of God, the law, the covenant. They committed every kind of sin, and Hosea holds nothing back in telling us just what the habits of the people were. And so, with the death of Jeroboam the second, everything begins to go downhill and just fall to pieces. And it is a judgment of God. And with steep decline terminating for the north with the Assyrian invasion and the complete wiping out of the country and the transportation of so many of the men to elsewhere. So it was devastating, and they were humbled. And it's before all that happens that Hosea is called to give this tremendous warning to the nation. So we begin there, essentially at the beginning of his prophecy, or at least this written portion of it, in verse 2. And the Lord said to Hosea, Go, take unto thee a wife of whoredoms, a prostitute, and children of whoredoms, for the land. And this marriage of Hosea's to a prostitute is going to parallel what is going on in the land. There's always been debate as to whether Hosea literally did marry a prostitute or whether this was just a figure he was given for the basis of his preaching. But the language of the book is very literal, and even the mother of the woman is named, and it all points to this being a literal marriage and his children really being children born to that marriage, though probably only the first was Hosea's own child. But nevertheless, he really did marry a woman. But was she a prostitute when he married her? Probably not. I think we may assume not. And that Hosea is reporting this, looking back on it, "Go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms." Now here's the dispute. No doubt she was not a prostitute when he married her, but did he know in advance that she would become one? It certainly sounds like it, but it doesn't necessarily follow. Hosea may be looking back on the event and saying, of course the land knew that his wife had become extremely unfaithful to him, and he'd used it in his preaching as an illustration of the conduct of Israel. But it may be that with the land knowing that, he looks back and he says, God told me to marry a prostitute, not implying that she was so at the time or that he even knew she would be, but that just looking at it, looking back at it, God ordained all this to be so, he says. So the language he uses could accommodate that. So he either married her when she was a prostitute, unlikely, or he knew she would become one when he married her, because God had said so to him, and that would have been very hard for him to do, but it would have showed his faithfulness and dedication to God, if that was God's will, that this would be how things would turn out. Or it could be that he wasn't told that much when he actually sought to marry, and it's difficult to work out which of the latter two is really so. But anyway, I explain that if that makes sense to you. The Lord said to Hosea, "Go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms for the land." This is going to be the purpose. Even though there are going to be unhappy circumstances following from his marriage, it will be partly the basis of his preaching and of this message, and partly Hosea, who evidently, from the chapters that follow, really loved this woman very dearly and was called to show compassion on her, so that Hosea could entirely identify with the pain and the message of God as he preached these things. That would be the fundamental purpose. So he went, verse 3, and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. And the Lord said, verse 4, unto Hosea, "Call his name Jezreel." Now that is a valley in Israel, but the meaning of the word is scatter. Jezreel, scatter. And it's also used for sowing, because of course when you sow seed, you do scatter it. And here there's a play on this name in Hosea, because when the word is first used, it means scatter. Call his name Jezreel, because the people are going to be scattered. But a little later on, when talking about how God will gather a remnant of Israel, and with together with the Gentiles, will sow a new nation, a new covenant, the Church of Jesus Christ, the word is used again in the sense of sowing. And there's a deliberate contrast. So at the beginning, it's used to designate scatter. Call his name Jezreel. "For yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel." The northern kingdom is coming to an end. I'm not for the moment going to go into the question of avenging the blood on account of Jehu, but the essence of the prophecy is that the northern kingdom is going to end, and it's going to be scattered, which of course literally took place. in 722 when Samaria fell and there was massive transportation carried out by the Assyrians of the Israelites. And verse 5, it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And then Gomer conceived again and bare a daughter. And her name was Lo-Ruhamah. And the meaning of that name was extremely significant because it means without mercy. And there's the negative on the front. Without mercy, it's going to be the end of the kingdom. So the first child is scattered, and the second child is without mercy. And these consecutive children represent what will happen to Israel in the course of time, fairly shortly. For I will, verse 6, I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, the meaning of the name explained there, but I will utterly take them away. And then in verse 7, but I will have mercy upon the house of Judah in the south. The conduct of Judah was very bad, but not so bad. And the line of their kings was much more wholesome than up in Israel. I will have mercy upon the house of Judah and will save them by the Lord their God. And then, more detail, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, by horses, nor by horsemen. Now that's very interesting, because you know that when, a little later on, the terrible fate hung over Judah of Sennacherib, the then Assyrian Empire, coming down into Judah and taking all the walled cities, Jerusalem did not fall. And Judah was saved. And she did not fall because, as you know, the army of Sennacherib was destroyed by the angel of the Lord. A most conspicuous and significant act of God. So it wasn't through Judah's horsemen or defenders or archers or anything else, but by an intervention of the Lord directly, exactly in accordance with the prophecy of Hosea here in verse 7. Now when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bare a son. Then said God, call his name Lo-Ammi, for ye are not my people. That's the meaning of the name, not my people. And I will not be your God. The implication, by the way, is that these second two children of Gomer were the result of unfaithfulness. And everybody knew it. So the message was plain, and their names had a meaning. And what was happening to this most conspicuous prophet was exactly what would happen to the nation. So, no mercy and not my people, and I will not be your God. Verse 6 is very emphatic. No more mercy upon the house of Israel, utterly taken away, and I will not be your God. Now this is specifically spoken to the house of Israel, but it will in due course apply to both houses, Israel and Judah. Yet, verse 10, yet the number of the children of Israel, the ancient promise made to Abraham, shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered, and it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. Now this is a great mystery, this verse. All the emphatic prophecies that Israel is going to be taken away and ended, and no more mercy, and yet suddenly, out of the blue, comes this promise that the ancient promise to Abraham will be kept. It implies a perpetuation of the nation. It implies vast numbers of children of Abraham. And yet the statement is made, and it puzzles us all the more as we look at it, halfway through verse 10, this is what will come to pass. The people to whom it was said, ye are not my people, it shall be said to them, ye are the sons of the living God. And before solving the problem, let's look at verse 11. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and be united once again and appoint themselves one head or subordinate themselves to one head. Equally, it could be translated. And they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. What's going on? Jezreel meant scattered, but now it's used in the sense of meaning sown. There'll be a great sowing. The opposite is going to take place of everything which has been prophesied. Well, is this a great contradiction? Are we wasting our time reading the prophecies, though they seemed to come to pass at the early part of the chapter, when there were wonderful promises of restoration and rehabilitation in the second part of the chapter? Well, the solution is this, that it won't be the house of Israel ethnically and the house of Judah ultimately ethnically that are being restored, but a remnant of them. The doctrine of the remnant, which is taught in so many of these prophetic pages. There'll be just a remnant of them, not a total restoration, and the Gentiles will be gathered in. So, even though Judah and Israel were never literally reunited historically, the remnant of them will be reunited, and together with the Gentiles, in the Church of Jesus Christ. And that is the sense of the prophecy. It's left as a mystery here to the immediate readers of Hosea. We don't understand entirely what's going on. Altogether lost, no more mercy, and yet a mysterious ingathering and a sowing of a new nation in unity. Well, of course, there's more clarification as the prophecies go on, but there's still going to be an element of mystery in the prophecies of Hosea. However, so that you can see the direction before we go into chapter 2, let me turn you to Romans 9, where these very verses are quoted. Or before going there, I'll quote one more verse from chapter 2 and verse 23, and that's important to us because the prophet Hosea utters very similar words. And I will sow her unto me in the earth, this new nation, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them that were not my people, thou art my people. And they shall say, thou art my God. We'll come to that, but now I want to turn you to Romans chapter 9, and I'll read from verse 22. And the Apostle Paul quotes these words of Hosea. What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction? That certainly fits the 8th century Israelites. And that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he had afore prepared unto glory, even us. Us, he's writing to the Romans, a Gentile church, even us whom he hath called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles, as he saith also in Hosea, I will call them my people which were not my people, and her beloved which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there shall they be called the children of the living God. And then he quotes from Isaiah in verse 27, Isaiah also crieth concerning Israel, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. Now that makes it very plain. If we didn't understand Hosea when we originally read it, we certainly understand that passage when we read the use that the Apostle Paul makes of it under inspiration. And he tells us that this great prophecy of Hosea is speaking about the time when Christ will come and the New Testament will come and then the people will be the remnant of Israel, of people of Israel and Judah will be gathered together with the Gentiles in the International Jewish Gentile Church of Jesus Christ right to the end of the age. And the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2 uses the same words, and I read from verses 9 to 10. Ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, an holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvellous light, which in time past, Hosea coming in again, you see, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. And Peter is saying, you Jews, your nation was cut off, but here are you, some Jews, who have been made not a people, now you are made the people of God. And the Gentiles, who never were the people of God, are made also the people of God. So Hosea's words apply to Christ and the New Testament and the New Covenant. And that's how we must understand the prophecy. So verse 11 of Hosea chapter 1, then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head. They'll come willingly under Jesus Christ, the Lord and Saviour. And they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel, or sowing. Now, the first verse of chapter 2 belongs on the end of chapter 1. It's one of those controversial things that the uninspired editor of chapters inserted chapter 2 just where he did. We should read straight on, great shall be the day of Jezreel. Say ye unto your brethren, am I, and to your sisters, Ruhamah. And the significance of this is that the same two names of the second and third children are here used again without the negative parts. So, say to your brethren, my people, and loved and shown mercy. The names are to be changed effectively, because the people who were rejected and not shown mercy now in the prophecy of the last verses of chapter 1 are shown mercy. But it's not a reversal. It's not the whole of Israel that's been condemned, or the whole of Judah that will be condemned and no more. It's a remnant of them brought in a new day. Now verse 2 of chapter 2 is appealing to them, but it's appealing to all the children of the land. It really should be quite separated from verse 1. It's speaking to the Israelites now, plead with your mother, their mother being the nation. Plead with your nation. Plead, for she is not my wife. She's been rejected, you see. Just as Gomer, Hosea's wife, has gone off from him. And the nation that God had called his wife, he is the husband, the nation is the wife, and she's the mother of her children, but she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight. That's going to be the appeal of God. It's God speaking here, as we can see from down in verse 13. And then there are the threats and the warnings of Hosea. In chapter 2, he's alluding, you see, to what in their culture and in their society the husband would do for a blatantly disloyal wife. He would take away the presents and the gifts and so on he'd given her and turn her over to the ones with whom she committed adultery. And this will happen to the nation, says God. In chapter 2 and verse 3, she'll be rejected and all her benefits will be taken away. Well, that is literally what happened to Israel and then later to Judah. The ministry was taken, the land was diminished, and she was abandoned. That's what's happened, though Israel is certainly not analogous to Britain, to England, but that's what's happened to England. As faith has been rejected and spurned, so benefits have been removed. The church has shrunk greatly. Ministry is being withdrawn from the land. The gospel is not preached anything like as much as it used to be preached. These blessings and benefits seem to be withdrawn from the nation because of the rejection of God in every conceivable way. Verse 4, back to Israel, "And I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of prostitution. For their mother hath played the harlot," verse 4. "She hath conceived them, she that conceived them has done shamefully." And then halfway through verse 5, you can see the criticisms of the land and the reproofs. "For she said, I will go after my lovers that give me my benefits, my food and my clothing," and so on. So now she's crediting all her benefits to her gods, Baal and the false gods, and they get the credit for what God has given her, and so God will take away what he's given her. Verse 6, "Therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns, and make a wall, that she shall not find her paths. And she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them." And so God will work in such a strange way that that nation which is worshipping Baal, false gods, idols, will soon find total disenchantment with them also, and then have nowhere to go. She's rejected God. The idolatry that she follows will be a source of great dissatisfaction and unhappiness. She'll want to go back to her original husband, the end of verse 7. And then this great statement in verse 8, "For she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold." She did not know it. She did not acknowledge or even notice the true source of all her wealth and benefits. And so she's going to have them taken away and removed. That's happening in a measure in our society. You think of the years, recent decades we've lived through, where God has been almost utterly rejected, and in public life and in the media, and despised and scorned. And some most significant things have been taken away from the land. Their integrity has been taken away. Probity in public life and in the professional world. I'd hardly mention the banking crash and all these things. And where even two decades ago you would have looked for honesty and integrity, even among unbelievers in these spheres of life, all integrity and probity seems to have been removed. It's as though God is saying to our nation, "You, if inherited the benefits of a Christian past, the moral benefits and the order and everything else, you reject God, and I will take from you those benefits." And things will increasingly collapse, and they'll collapse far more than we've seen at this stage. You look around the world to non-Christian nations, Islamic nations, communist nations, and see the state of bureaucracies and the lack of order and integrity everywhere. Well, that's exactly that is going to happen here in this country, and we're in the process of observing it. But I must come back to these verses. It's how God dealt with Israel, certainly, in those days. The benefits were removed. And verse 11, as far as Israel is concerned, all laughter and happiness and joy was going to be taken away from the Lord and everything that she depended upon. But coming down to verse 14, then come the opposite positive prophecies again. The great love of God. One moment rejected, but then chapter 2 verse 14, "Therefore, behold," you might put it in our way, "yet, behold," would make the sense clearer. Here's a great contrast coming. "I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably, tenderly, lovingly, is the Hebrew, to her. What? After all that? There's going to be a season of mercy, at least to a remnant of Jewish people and to Gentiles, who, though they don't have the benefits and the blessings, are just as bad, if not worse, in terms of their wickedness and their sin. But nevertheless, God, in his amazing love and pity and tenderness, is going to call and appeal and draw. Why bring her into the wilderness? Well, because, not because it's going to literally be a wilderness, but because the wilderness was where God courted Israel before. He brought her out of Egypt, and then he dealt so wonderfully with her in the wilderness, with the manna and the provisions and all kinds of ministry. She reacted poorly, very badly, but this is going to happen again. There's going to be redemption. There's going to be a time of God appealing and speaking. Of course, that happened with the coming of Christ. There were historic, foretastes of it in great deliverances. I mentioned Sennacherib and the deliverance of Jerusalem, where she escaped by the skin of her teeth. And then Judah was taken into captivity in Babylon for 70 years, and there was a great token release, and back they came, or many of them, a remnant of them, into the Holy Land. But then the great day that's really referred to is Christ, when he appealed to the nation. And then the apostles, the apostle Peter on the day of Pentecost, pleading, drawing the people, and I'll speak lovingly to her. And verse 15, there will be many people saved, and the New Testament church will be formed. And verse 15, I will give her vineyards from thence, and the valley of Achor, that's the valley of trouble, will become instead a door of hope. There's a door now being entered, a new era, and she shall sing there, as in the days of her youth, the praises of the Church of Jesus Christ, and as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt, a yet more significant deliverance will take place. Verse 16, chapter 2, it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishai, and no more Baalai. For I will take away the names of Baal. The significance of this is that hit there, down there in verse 16, Baalai literally means master, whereas Ishai means husband. When that day comes, you'll call me my husband. There'll be a much closer relationship than master. You won't call me master. I will not be a god just of fear to you. You serve out of fear. That's how you serve Baal. But I will be your husband, and there'll be a closeness never previously seen. And then down in verse 18, and in that day will I make a covenant, a new covenant is to be made. And the covenant, strangely, is made for them, for the new church, the new nation, the new order, but it's made for them with the beasts of the field, with the fowls of heaven. And we're mystified. Until we read on in the verse, and with the creeping things of the ground, and I will break the bow and the sword and the cattle battle out of the earth, and will make them to lie down safely. So we realize the significance. In this New Testament covenant, all destructive forces will be curbed. So the beasts of the field mean the lions and the bears and beasts that would tear them evidently, and vultures and birds of prey that might attack them, or their flocks, and snakes on the ground, and the bow and the battle. So the teaching here is, when this new covenant comes, everything will work for the security and the eternal spiritual good of God's people. It's the doctrine of the perseverance of the saints. It will no longer be a history of Judah and Israel going over to idolatry, being diminished, being punished. Truly converted people in the New Testament era will have a solid and lasting relationship with the Lord, who will see them through life and eternity under this new covenant. And verse 19, that I will betroth thee unto me forever. There no more will be, as in Jewish times, saints and sinners mixed together, a small number of faithful, but the majority of people never truly being converted. But now it'll be a regenerate church, true believers, betrothed unto God for all eternity, and betrothed to him in verse 19, righteousness, judgment, loving kindness, mercies, and verse 20, in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. That's the New Testament era. That's true believers, born-again Christians, whether ethnic Jews or Gentiles, in the New Testament Church of Christ. And verse 21, and it shall come to pass in that day, I will hear, saith the Lord. Listen to the prayers of my people. I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth, which seems to be an illustration of rain and crops. The heavens will hear too, and the earth will be watered. And so in agrarian terms, in terms of prosperity through crops and so on, the blessings, the spiritual blessings of God's people are described. But Old Testament farming language is used, and obviously it's New Testament spiritual blessings that we understand by this language. Verse 22, and the earth shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel. A church is planted. And although this is a mysterious verse, it most probably means that not only will God hear, and not only will he pour out blessings, but the earth shall hear that these are believers who have been blessed, because the true church will have a great testimony. Verse 23 follows that up, and I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them which were not my people, thou art my people. And they shall say, thou art my God. Well, we've time just to look into chapter 3. And we've seen already in Hosea the great prophecy of the destruction or the withdrawing of the old order, the Church of the Jews, and yet the salvation of many Jews and many Gentiles in the Church of Christ. The Gentiles are not mentioned in these early chapters in Hosea. Now, chapter 3. Then the Lord said unto me, and we go back now to Hosea's marital situation, which is an illustration of what God is doing to the land. Then said the Lord unto me, this is now narrated by Hosea, go yet, notwithstanding all that's happened, go yet, love a woman beloved of her friend. Well, the friend is Hosea, and the woman is Gomer. She's not with him. She's gone. Yet an adulteress, according to the love of the Lord toward the children of Israel, who look to other gods and love flagons of wine. So now, go and woo her. Bring her back. Look after her. Hosea, evidently from the subsequent language used, is happy to do that, despite her unfaithfulness. He loves this lady, in spite of her dreadful behavior. So verse 2, so I bought her to me. He ransomed her. She's evidently in slavery. He gets her quite cheaply, 15 pieces of silver. That's a fair weight of silver, but it isn't a fortune. And for barley, and homer and a half. And I said unto her, thou shalt abide for me many days. This is a testing period. Thou shalt not play the harlot, and thou shalt not be for another man. So will I also be for thee. If you can stay with me for so many days and be faithful, I will take you back. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king. You know that was literally true of the northern kingdom. After the fall of Samaria, they never had another king. They were never re-established as a kingdom. And without a prince, and without a sacrifice, and without an image, without false gods either, and without an ephod for guidance or a priest, and without a teraphim, they would not exist, and Judah would be in the same position. After a while, and verse 5, afterward, and after all that, shall the children of Israel return, and seek the Lord their God, and David their king, as Christ, the son of David, and shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. Now, we don't believe that's a restoration of all the Jews. That's the same as before. That's the remnant who would be saved in New Testament times with the church of Jesus Christ. Well, I'm just going through in a very brief expository manner, verse by verse, to show the coherent and the logical sequence of teaching in this prophecy. Because when you just read it through, it can seem very confusing. It can seem jumbled. It isn't at all. It's very straightforward and very logical, especially as we have a key, an informing key to turn in the lock in the New Testament use of those pivotal verses. So the whole meaning becomes very clear. Well, just one moment in chapter 4. And now Hosea turns to warning the land. But there are applications here for today. Hear the word of the Lord, ye children of Israel. I think he's speaking to both Israel and Judah. It's very significant, by the way, that in the first verse, he mentions mainly kings of Judah, and he names only one king of Israel, though his reign covered several of those also. Well, all of them, all the remaining six kings of Israel. And that's a bit of a mystery. Why mention all the kings of Judah and only one of the kings of Israel? But at least it tells us this, that his burden and his prophecy is as much for Judah as it is for Israel. Though he uses the term Israel chiefly, he's clearly speaking to the whole land. Hear the word of the Lord, ye children of Israel, for the Lord hath a controversy with the inhabitants of the land, because there is no truth, they were liars, nor mercy, no compassion, nor knowledge of God in the land. Knowledge of God we'll pick up in just a moment. Details, swearing, false oaths, lying, murder, killing, stealing, committing adultery, and even within families, terrible feuds. Verse 3, therefore shall the land mourn, and the judgment will come, and all resources will be taken away. And in verse 4, yet let no man strive nor reprove another. You can't do that with these people. They're so bad, nobody can reprove anybody. They'd murder you if you tried. For thy people are as they that strive with the priest. The priests are useless, of course. But nevertheless, this, by the way, proves that Hosea, though he keeps saying Israel, is addressing Judah as well, because there were no priests in Israel. They were all down in the south in Judah. Therefore shalt thou fall in the day. And the prophet also, there seems to have been false prophets, also shall fall with thee in the night, and I will destroy thy mother, which means thy nation. And then verse 6, and we'll stop with this. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. That's the second time it's been mentioned. Because thou hast rejected knowledge, I will also reject thee. That's interesting. In the time of the Wesleys and Whitfield, in the 1700s, they would say frequently, the trouble with the country is that there is no knowledge of the new birth. They didn't say there is no knowledge of God. In basic things, the people were nominally well taught. They were only just emerging from the period in which all British people or English people had to go to church by compulsion of law. And the Christian religion was taught, but there was no spiritual life in the land. But everybody knew the basic doctrines of the Bible and the characters of the Bible and the message of Christ, but not in a saving way. And the Wesleys and Whitfield and others who preached with them, this was something they said continually. Nobody knows about the new birth, about conversion, about personal repentance and faith, about their condemnation. They all think they are Christians because they're all compelled to go to church and because they all know the essentials of the Christian religion without salvation. So that was their great task, to teach those facts. But in Israel, in these times, in the 8th century BC, it was even worse. Even their basic knowledge of their faith had disappeared from the land. And that is exactly how it is today. Although we have to be very careful not to draw too close a tie between Israel and Britain, or England particularly, if you like, because there is no direct connection. We can't say everything that God did to Israel, he will do to this country. That was a special case. Nevertheless, there are many parallels, and we are in exactly this position now. There is massive, almost total ignorance of even the basic things of theism and God or anything in our land. And one of the things Hosea does is point out that the foundation of the terrible state of Israel then and Judah was that knowledge had gone. People were ignorant. They were willfully ignorant. Baal worship and idolatry had been in for so long. They still went to their temple, in Jerusalem at any rate, not up in Israel. And they still went down in the south to certain places of worship, but they didn't know anything. And that situation is exactly ours now. When we preach, it might tire you a little if you love the faith and you're born again and you know Christ and have done so for many years. Why in gospel services is there constantly a rehearsal of even the most basic things about God and about faith? Why is it necessary to speak of his holiness and man's sinfulness and to prove these things so carefully? Your heart is saying to you, oh, well, can't we take this as read? I've heard this so many times. I understand it very deeply. But we have to preach like that because people who are unsaved or who are visitors, they know nothing. Nothing at all. There is no knowledge. We have to teach everything. We have to teach not only Christ and his love and the atonement and the need of conversion, but we have to teach even the basics of Christian religious theory. Everything has to come in. And we have to teach the benefits of the gospel too. And Hosea says this a little later on. I promise not to go further, but he says exactly the same thing in his day. The benefits of returning to God have to be spelled out as though these people had been plucked straight out of a pagan nation. They know nothing. And knowledge is the basis of the understanding that the Spirit uses to bring people under conviction. So in our evangelistic preaching, we have to say everything, the basics, the doctrines of salvation, the fruits, the benefits, the warnings of condemnation. So actually, Hosea, in much of the material from chapter 4 on, is almost a 2012 training course in witness and preaching in our modern times. because the same things have to be stressed as are in this book. But anyway, we've looked at the condemnation and the love and the bringing in of the New Testament age and God saying, as it were, though I have done such special things for this representative nation, Judah in the south, Israel in the north, and though they have rejected me despite everything, I will still find a way of pouring out my love upon a remnant of lost men and women and bringing them to everlasting salvation. That's the message of Hosea. Let's